Okay, my task is to tell you, as if you don't know already, something about what happened last year with healthcare reform, and as a lead-in to the rest of the speakers. The usual no financial relationship. This is why healthcare reform was on the national agenda. This is the rise in healthcare costs over basically during the Bush years, the W Bush years. A doubling of the cost. This is what employers have been paying since 1999 through 2010. This year the average employer total cost was almost $14,000, of which the employees paid about $4,000. This is an extraordinary, as you can see, the cost more than doubled in this decade. This is why it became a political issue. Both employers and employees and the political system recognize that this is an unsustainable rise in healthcare costs. Nevertheless, well, this is the other problem that the country has, the problem of the uninsured. It's a serious moral problem. That we're alone in the civilized world if this country continues to be civilized. Some of us have doubts in having this kind of a moral problem. But the interesting thing is that if you look at the rate of the uninsured, except for the recession of the last 2 years, the uninsured rate basically is unchanged over 20 years. This is not why healthcare was on the agenda this year. It would have been on the agenda long ago if there was really concern. And yet, this is the problem that the legislation that was passed attempts to deal with. It does not, as I'll describe a little later, in fact, deal with what put healthcare on the agenda, the inflationary spiral that healthcare costs have been undergoing actually for the last 40 years. So the new health plan I've addressed, let me comment on the footnote a minute. I guess my comment will be a political one. You can tell people's political orientation by what they call the new act. If they're really against it, they call it Obamacare. The advocates and the government, the administration, and advocates for it call it ACA. I've never heard anybody say ACA or something. It's the Affordable Care Act. We call it PPACA, which is its proper acronym. It's the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act. However, of course, it neither protects patients nor is affordable. It provides insurance coverage probably for some, but it does almost nothing about cost. Here a few facts about how we spend our money on healthcare. This is where we get our insurance today. About half of us get insurance through employers, another 8 or 9% buy it ourselves, either we're self-employed or don't have a job. About an eighth are on Medicare, an eighth and more are on Medicaid. It grows as the economy worsens, Medicaid grows. There's those covered by the military, and then there's the uninsured, which reached a little bit more than 50 million this year. So this is where we get our coverage. This is where the money comes from. And the interesting thing that I want to point out to you, this is the federal government's share. About a third of all costs today are paid by the federal government. Medicare, which is totally federally funded, and Medicaid, which is about 50% federally funded. States provide about an eighth, 13%, states and local government. There's still private funds, substantial. And then there is private insurance, which accounts for only a third of all spending, even though 60% of American people get their insurance through private insurance. As I point out to my students, the reason for that is that private insurance covers the healthy part of the population. This is an example of what in the 60s was called lemon socialism. That is, the government pays for insurance for those segments of the population, namely the elderly and the poor, who are most likely to need health services, and the private sector covers that portion who uses health care least. I've shown here the federal subsidy for private insurance. That insurance is tax deductible on the part of the insurers, of the employers. And so the public sector overall is already paying for more than half of all health care. And I'll come back to that point in a minute. Another thing that's been happening over the last decade is steep decline in the coverage of, in the percentage of the population covered by employer-based insurance, from 68% down to 58% in this decade. When PPACA goes completely into effect in the later part of this decade, the public sector, even more of the money in the healthcare system will be coming from the public sector because of the subsidies, the very subsidies that are built into the legislation and the taxes that are, the tax increases that are a modest part of it. And you can see that the straight public sector part, not even counting the tax subsidy over here in private insurance, that the straight public sector part is more than 50% of all spending. These estimates are from the Congressional Budget Office and from the Lewin Group. So the president, given that financial picture, the president had a choice. He could have built on the public sector, which, as I say, is providing about 50% or more of already of healthcare costs, or he could have chosen to expand on the private sector. And as we know, he chose to build his program on private insurance, to leave the basic structure of healthcare finance in this country unchanged, and to try to achieve the goals of healthcare reform to contain costs and expand access by changing the behavior of private insurance companies through regulation. In order to do that, he made a number of deals. Some are public, all now are public, but at the time they were not all public. He assured the insurance industry, in contradiction to his campaign, the big argument he had with Hillary Clinton, of course, was whether there should be a mandate. His position was there should not be a mandate, there should be a public option to contain the insurance company's costs. But in fact, what he did was assure the insurance industry that there would be a mandate so that everybody would be required to buy its product and that there would be no public option. And at the end, when it came down to the wire in March of this year, he omitted the public option from his plan when he finally put his own plan forward. They assured the drug industry there'd be no negotiation on price, and what they extracted from the drug industry was a small subsidy to the elderly in the donut hole, a so-called donut hole in Part D. They assured the AMA there'd be no cut in physician fees to hospitals, that there'd be no cut in reimbursements, although there would be a slower growth in their payments. They'd have a lot more paying customers because of the expansion of private insurance. Employers are given continued control of health benefits. We continue to have an employer-based insurance system. And to nervous members of the public, he told them you can keep what you have, although in fact that's not true. There's nothing in the law that assures individuals that their employers will continue to provide them with the kind of insurance they've had. So the problem facing the program, facing PPACA, is that private insurance is simply too expensive for many people at $14,000 and rising. It's complex and deficient. It's copays and it's deductibles and failures of the insurance companies to abide by the coverage that you thought you had when you actually get sick. And the fact that private insurance is profitable for insurers when they can avoid sick people. And limit what they have to pay when people do get sick. The reform program tries to solve these problems by subsidies for individuals and employers to make insurance affordable and by trying to tame the insurance companies through regulation. What's the overall consequences of PPACA? Continued reliance on private insurance. Basically, employment-based insurance is unchanged. All the talk about that you hear about subsidies and about exchanges have to do with insurance outside of the employment-based system. Market competition will determine what healthcare costs. There are no cost controls or cost targets. The market will also determine how insurance companies behave. There's nothing but, and this is the crucial point on costs, there's nothing but experimental pilot programs to try and reduce system costs. So there'll be no likely reduction, certainly no assurance of any reduction in costs or waste. The result is that the program, in fact, will make very little difference for most people because it doesn't really change the way we pay for healthcare. So what does it do? I'll give you three, there are three slides here that are a very tight summary of what it does. Beginning right now, insurance companies are required to cover dependent children. There are no lifetime limits on coverage, dollar limits on coverage. It begins to close the donut hole with a $250 payment this year, finally closed 10 years from now. Government is going to begin to review basically increases in insurance premiums, but there's no teeth. There's nothing. The government can't do anything except jawbone, as they say, if the premiums are high. And the Medicare is going to start various experimental programs to reduce costs. They usually go under the name of the primary care medical home and accountable care organizations. Starting in 2014, when the plan really goes into effect in full force, citizens and legal immigrants will be required to be insured with penalties that are about 2.5% of income. That is, they start smaller than that, and after 2 or 3 years, they go up to 2.5% of income. So people on the one hand are required to buy insurance, the other hand, insurers are required to take you, guaranteed issue. State-based insurance exchanges, one of the big wins of conservatives was the Senate coming forth with a plan that had the exchanges based in the states rather than through being a federal exchange, so that there are going to be struggles in 50 states, and when the system fails, it's going to fail in 50 very different ways. So state-based exchanges where individuals and small employers who don't now provide insurance can buy it with subsidies up to 400% of poverty. The subsidies are intended within that income range to reduce the premium to 9.5% of income. There's this weird, well, I'll come to it right here. There is a hardship waiver. That is, you will be allowed to remain uninsured. Massachusetts, as we'll hear, has a similar proviso in its law. If the premium that you have to pay is greater than 8% of income, well, curiously, the Congress didn't quite get its act together. Even with subsidies, the premium is greater than 8%. And finally, Medicaid will not be categorical. That is, anybody whose income is below 133% of poverty will be eligible for Medicaid. The public option was the possibility there would be a public plan to choose within these exchanges or in general disappeared. The original idea was any of us could sign up for the public plan. Even if we were getting insurance through our employers, we could choose a public plan instead. The Lewin Group, a consulting firm in Washington, estimated that 119 million of the 200 million people now getting their insurance through employers from a private insurance company would change instead to the public plan because it would be cheaper. The Congress went crazy. This was July of 2009 when it got that number and immediately transformed the idea of a public option to being limited to those who have no insurance. That is, if your employer provides insurance, not only does your employer have to provide you insurance, but you have to take it. That is, you can't choose to go into the exchange. So the public plan that was available at that time in the congressional plan was a very small one. It might have had 6 million members. Remember, Medicare has 43 right now. And as I say, the 800-pound gorilla turned into a mouse, and then Obama eliminated it. So what's the upshot? This is the kind of curve you will see. This is from the Congressional Budget Office, but the CMS actuary from the Medicare Services Office and Commonwealth Fund, which is another advocate for this plan, all have similar projections. This is a projection of the uninsured without the plan. This is the projection with it. You will hear that 32 million people will be insured under this plan. That is false. That is simply not true. The estimate here is that 31 million people will choose to buy insurance or to sign up for Medicare. The Medicare eligibility is not automatic. You have to apply for it. Yesterday, and the estimate here is that of these 30 million people, about half will be on Medicare because of the Medicaid, because of the expansion of Medicaid. If I said Medicare a minute ago, I meant Medicaid. John Holohan yesterday in a session had an estimate for the Medicaid population. His estimate was somewhere between 16 and 25 million people, depending on your assumptions. That is, there's a range. This is not hard and fast number. Similarly, the number of people who will sign up for private insurance in the exchange is not the kind of hard and fast number you hear, like 19 million people is the number you often hear. It depends on how many people choose instead to take the hardship waiver or how many people just choose to pay 2.5% of their income instead of 9.5% or 10.5% or 12% or 20% of their income, which is what the premium is going to be in by 4 years from now, to get shoddy insurance full of holes, full of co-pays and deductibles. So this is the estimate. This is the estimate of the advocates, I would say, for this plan. But it's a very, very fuzzy number, and one should think about error bars there of very large error bars. I mean, the simple bottom line message is there will be at least 20 million people still uninsured. Some of those will be undocumented immigrants who are totally left out of this plan. But a lot will be people who can't afford it or who get a hardship waiver. And finally, it does not control costs. This is the estimates of the advocates for this plan. This is three projections from the CBO, from the CMS, and from Commonwealth. 6% continued growth in healthcare costs through the decade, over 20% of the GDP. By the end of the decade, with reform, with this thing that is being called reform. This does not address the source of the problem that led us here. So what's the bottom line? That what is now the world's most expensive healthcare system is going to get even more expensive. We will not have universal coverage. We won't have affordable insurance. We will still have millions uninsured and poorly insured. And we won't control the continuing growth of costs. And that's because it doesn't really change the way we pay for health care. So PPACA won't lead to universal coverage. It won't control costs. Only an expanded, as you will hear, public Medicare for All program can provide comprehensive services, costs no more than we now spend, as at least 18 studies have shown since 1991, and control costs going into the future. Real healthcare reform built on Medicare for All continues to be essential. Thank you.
We'll save questions to the end, so if you can just remember them, that'd be good. Thank you, Len. The next speaker is Sarah Kemble. Sarah is a graduate of Albany Medical College, Bay State Medical Center's residency in internal medicine, University of Massachusetts Medical School's residency in general preventative medicine, and the University of Massachusetts School of Public Health and Health Sciences. She's the founder and chief quality officer of the Community Health Center of Franklin County, Desmond Callan Community Health Center, which she founded in 1995.
Thank you. My disclosure is no financial conflicts of interest, and further, I'm not even an academic, which you can tell because I have no slides. This is the first time I'm giving this talk, and I would love to have feedback because I would like to take it on the road in southern Vermont, which is in my neighborhood, to help the Vermonters in their quest for single payer. When healthcare reform was passed 4 years ago, I was extremely downhearted about it because it was very clear that there was an ideological commitment to maintaining the current system as it was and to commodify, to really set in stone the commodification of the caring relationship. And I can tell you 4 years later that Today in Massachusetts, I'll just tell you the punchline first and then give you the details. Everyone is uninsured, cost is out of control, and commodification is complete. So if you have to leave, I've told you the conclusions. We owe so much to the quote of the day, and the quote of the day this morning, I thought I would just read from it. Don McCann's excellent service. He's quoting from the interview with President Obama, who said the other night, he said, "I made the decision to go ahead and do it. And it proved as costly politically as we expected, probably actually a little more costly than we expected politically." And Steve Croft said, "In what ways?" The president goes on, "Well, partly because I couldn't get the kind of cooperation from Republicans that I had hoped for. We thought that if we shaped a bill that wasn't that different from bills that had been introduced by Republicans, including a Republican governor in Massachusetts, who's now running for president, that, you know, we would be able to find some common ground there. And we just couldn't." So, to go back to before healthcare reform in my state, in 2005, there were a couple drivers for this reform. One was that we did have quite high spending on the uninsured. We had a thing called the uncompensated care pool, which was a tax on the insurance industry and hospitals. And the pool had actually replaced, under pressure from the insurance industry, a thing called the Rate Setting Commission in the back in the late 80s, early 90s. And it covered the cost of the uninsured. In 2005, the pool paid out $750 million. It covered 475,000 unduplicated individuals, and that's where some of the low estimates of how many uninsured we had came from. We know that not everyone sought care during that year, so they weren't counted if they didn't. The true estimates are closer to 700,000 or even higher. 90% of the individuals that the pool paid for were adults, working age adults, age 19 through 64. The dollars went 69% to hospitals, 22% to community health centers, and 9% went just directly to pay down emergency room bad debt, which is part of any American system of healthcare. Also in 2005, the political driver was that our Medicaid waiver that we had gotten in 1996 was on the line, and that there had to be a plan that would significantly expand coverage. So there was a political ticking clock and a deadline. So we got health care reform. Chapter 58 in 2006, it had four objectives. At first they said universal coverage. That was quickly amended to near universal coverage. An individual mandate, affordable coverage, defined as affordable premiums, forget about the actual health care, and then some insurance reforms, which actually were useful and partial. The individual market was taken up into the small group market. The thing that everyone is looking forward to now, that your children up to age 26 can remain on your insurance, we got that at that time, and a few other of those things. But the political decision was really made, and it was very openly discussed at the time, that coverage would be expanded and cost would be worried about later. So the coverage expansion was by taking that free care pool, that $750 million, and redirecting it through an insurance mechanism. This really was the saddest thing ever for me. It really constituted a raid on a pretty good public health mechanism for direct government payments to safety net providers to cover the cost of care. Simple. The pool had no premiums up to 200% of federal poverty level. Between 200 and 400% of federal poverty, there was a sliding fee co-insurance payment, but there were no explicit co-pays. There was direct fee-for-service payment, as I mentioned, from the state to the safety net providers. And we, based on a pretty simple fee-for-service cost report and income verification that we collected from the patients served. And we actually had 6 months to bill the pool retroactively in order to get paid. This was true for community health centers and hospitals and hospital-based primary care practices. The some big disadvantages or gaps in the pool mechanism was that patients who went to private primary care offices could not have their care covered. So there was a lot of fragmentation, and people would, if they lost their insurance, they would often be kicked out of a primary care practice. And there was no payment mechanism for any specialty care at all, or for drug coverage. There is still a residual pool. It's called the Health Safety Net, and it mostly covers the costs of care for people who have just moved to the state, who are going to be eligible for the subsidized insurance programs, and for legal immigrants who have no insurance. The individual mandate, part two, the second objective of the plan, became effective on July 1st, 2007. So when we file our income tax returns in Massachusetts now, we also have to, along with the W-2 form, there's a health insurance form that your payer sends you in the mail, and you attach it to your form. It verifies that you have been covered by minimum creditable coverage and specifies the dates of coverage. And I believe that you can actually be uncovered for up to three months of the year and still count as having been insured for the year. So think about what that means for fragmentation and churn. The so-called affordable coverage part of the act was basically turfed to a thing called the Healthcare Quality and Cost Council. It did meet and most publicly issued its recommendations, and those recommendations have not been followed. It also created a thing that some of us were extremely excited about for about 5 minutes, called the Racial and Ethnic Disparities Council, which, as far as I know, has not issued any output from its work. If I'm wrong, someone could correct me, but I think we never heard of it again. 4 years ago, 2006, yeah. So as of 2008, now we go two years ahead, and there most of the data that I'm going to give you is from various state agencies that have some regulatory say over this project. As of 2008, costs were out of control. 12% overall increase in the first 2 years of the healthcare reform. Our costs in Massachusetts are 15% higher than the national average after you correct for the higher cost of living. It's a cold climate. And for the teaching hospital effect, which is always a huge thing in our healthcare industry. And actually, many of the most super high-cost hospitals in Massachusetts are not teaching hospitals at all, which I'll get to. So the Healthcare Quality and Cost Council recommended that were not followed were, number one, move to global payments within 5 years with shared risk between the provider organizations and both private and public payers. That was sort of the birth of the ACO concept, which is definitely an idea with major legs, but no one exactly knows how it's going to really work. Number two, there was a recommendation that there needed to be a government but independent oversight board to look at the whole healthcare reform project. The problem was and still is that there are so many state agencies that have a different hand in this project that kind of the buck never stops. Everyone has their little piece of the action, the Department of Insurance, the Department of Revenue, the Executive Office of Health and Human Services, the Department of Public Health, and they each do their little aspect of it, but there is no oversight board. And as I said, that this recommendation so far has been ignored. In 2009, so the costs are out of control. As of 2009, quality was not so great either. And the Commonwealth Fund state scorecard showed that Massachusetts, when it came to insurance rates, was number one, but when it came to avoidable hospital admissions, was number 33. And that there was increasing use of emergency departments for primary care sensitive conditions. And this was not really shocking to us because the reform emphasized really access to insurance without any regard to the to the delivery care system that that of course has many flaws, and the scale of which was inadequate to absorb all these newly insured patients, especially the undersupply of primary care doctors and practices relative to specialty and tertiary care. So it's not a surprise that all these people who needed care and suddenly had a card would go to the high-cost tertiary care centers. So in 2010, our Attorney General, you might have heard of her, Martha Coakley, she ran against Scott Brown and lost. And she was being saved for greater things, I think. And we just reelected her by a landslide. She issued a report in early this year, a report on healthcare costs in Massachusetts, noting a 15% increase in per person spending over the 2 years since enactment of healthcare reform. And the state estimate is that this year we spend greater than $10,000 per capita on healthcare in Massachusetts. That's more than anyone else ever in the history of the world. But by 2020, we'll be spending, without any meaningful cost control, greater than $18,000 per capita on healthcare. And that's, you know, that's the state. That's an openly out there projection. That's not us lefties making that up. So Martha's report found that there were two cost drivers, and this is so interesting. One was that the price per unit of service had gone up hugely. Utilization had not gone up hugely. So you have to question how much extra access did we even buy for the poor or for people who had not had access before. And secondly, that the location, the locus of where care was being given had shifted from away from low cost efficient sites such as community health centers and into the more high cost sites. The other thing she found in this report is that price and payment variation was enormous for identical services at different facilities, up to 18-to-1 ratio for facility charges, facility payments, and up to 3-to-1 for professional services. And these differentials were not only due to the teaching hospital effect, but it was because of these strange contracting practices that we have locally, and it was I'm trying to figure out how I'm going to do this in 5 minutes, but I will try. I'll skip through a section of this, but suffice it to say that many of the most expensive hospitals are actually community hospitals, and what was found in the Coakley report was that the drivers of cost were solely related to the market leverage and size of the players in their contracting. So also this year, the Division of Healthcare Finance and Policy issued their final report on cost trends and found that the current rate of the uninsured in Massachusetts is 3%. Again, we think this is really an underestimate because you can be uninsured for up to 3 months in a year and still count as insured. And because that's just an average rate, the Urban Institute had a more realistic estimate as of June 2009 that for low-income residents, the uninsurance rate dropped from 24% only down to 13%, while for high-income residents, it went from 5% down to 3%. The Department of Revenue that collects our taxes estimates that 168,000 uninsured remain in Massachusetts, and out of these, 62,000 are the ones that get the waivers that Len was talking about that are allowed to be uninsured because they are deemed unable to afford health insurance, while 97,000 are deemed able to afford it, and they must pay an $800 per person penalty on their income taxes. The employment-based insurance system is also shaky. And so the assumption that the employment-based health insurance system can be left alone, not regulated, not really even looked at that much, is really called into question by our experience. Although 76% of employers still do provide health insurance to their employees, there's been an enormous process of cost shifting onto employees. So the rate of employers getting rid of their commercial insurance and going to self-insurance, which is unregulated by the insurance commissioners, is on the rise. Premium costs are increasing, and high deductible catastrophic plans have increased from 4% up to 11% of the total plans offered in the state. There is some good news. The newly covered patients are getting pretty good services, and I'll skip the details and keep moving. But the cost is a huge problem, and the current plans for cost control in our state are things that we already know are going to be not very successful. There's going to be an increase in pay for performance incentives to providers. There's going to be a transition away from fee-for-service to bundled payments. There's going to be a push toward the patient-centered medical home model. There's going to be a pretty immediate decrease and eventually elimination of payments for avoidable hospital admissions. And it's the writing is so on the wall that this won't work, that the prospect of actual rate setting again, and remember, we used to have a rate setting commission 20 years ago, 30 years ago, the prospect of rate setting is back on the horizon. And so the division's report, I'll just quote from it for a second, while oversight of health insurance premiums and provider rates are not ideal, I don't know why not, but long-term strategies, they are necessary short-term interventions to mitigate the unsustainable levels of healthcare cost growth that has occurred in recent years. And again, there is a call from the Division of Healthcare Finance and Policies for an independent public entity with the authority to regulate all aspects of health insurance in Massachusetts. And I would say that if there is one silver lining in all this, this is a political moment where a very imperfect attempt at reform is leading us very logically and rationally to the idea, to the real manifest need for a single government oversight body to regulate the behavior of all payers and providers in our state. And I think it will have to come to that, and hopefully the sooner the better. So I will leave it at that, and there's more things we could deal with in the question period.